The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, let's begin with a word of prayer, if you will. Dear Lord, thank you for this day. And just thank you for this wonderful opportunity to be with fellow educators and to just learn and to just enjoy each other's company. May we be inspired, may we be informed, and may we grow to love the things worth loving. And I just ask that you'll bless us during this time and during this conference. And in Jesus' name, amen. All right, I'm going to begin today the same way I begin my classes at Hillsdale College, which is saying thank you for you that you showed up today. You have choices, and you chose to be here. I hope by the end of the time today, you will discover it was worthwhile to be here. So thank you to all of you, and I'd like to also thank two other groups. How many of you were with me yesterday evening? In the workshop. All right. I would like to give a special thanks to you because you know what you're getting yourself into, and yet you still came today. And last but not least, is there anyone or is the group from table four last night? Are you here? All right. Very good. That's my table right there from last night. So you really know what you're getting yourself into. So thank you very much. All right. Let's get started here. I have a computer here. I'm hopefully going to remember to advance the slides. Listen, I'm not too proud that if I forget to advance a slide, just let me know. Someone wave or click the slide or something like that so I know to advance the slide, all right? So I have a podium, I have a computer, and I have my talk here. So it'll be interesting. I don't have a lot of space, so I'm going to do the best I possibly can. So, all right, let's get started. So I have three children. Our eldest is a boy. He's 18. He just graduated from high school. And then I have a 16-year-old who just completed the 10th grade. And then I have a 12-year-old who just completed the 6th grade. And my wife and I, we're trying to raise our children in a godly manner. In fact, we take our inspiration, as many of you do as parents, from a Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go. And even when he is old, he will not depart from it. So that's kind of my key verse for today. That should be the inspiration for what I want to tell you today about the moral imagination. And so my talk is called Wardrobe of Images, Classic Literature and the Moral Imagination. And hopefully that'll make sense by the time I get to the end of the talk. So my wife and I try not to be helicopter parents. We try not to hover over our children, trying to negotiate everything that they are doing. In addition, we try not to be what I've learned is snowplow parents, which is kind of plowing the way for our kids. We want our children to develop the social skills to get along with each other at home and to get along with a wide variety of people. And we think that that's a good education. We try not to solve all their problems. We try to hang back and allow them to negotiate with one another and to work things out. And we think that's good parenting. But all of you know, if you're a parent or a grandparent or an educator, you know that there's a time where you have to step in and you have to say, okay, that's enough, right? Well, I'm going to take you back to an episode when my son was 7, and my daughter was only 5 years old. And I heard my son teasing my daughter. And it was harmless at the beginning, but my daughter didn't like it. It started to go up a little bit. And then my 7-year-old went all in, right? And he just, started to unleash. And I realized at that time, okay, that's the line. He crossed the line. So I stepped in as a good parent and I said, oh, okay, that's enough. Quinn, you need to go down. My son's name is Quinn, by the way. Oh, by the way, if this story gets back to him, you're all in real trouble. So I said, Quinn, you need to go down, to your bedroom and just have a seat, and I'll be down there in a moment. So he went down to his room. I was glad for that, and closed the door. And so, you know, I gave myself a little bit of time. I thought, I pondered a little bit how I was going to approach this. And then I walked down the hall rather confidently that I had an understanding of what teasing was, the nature of teasing. So I went into his room, and he's over there on the bed, you're kind of having a seat there. And you could see it in his eyes, how much trouble am I in, that kind of a thing. So I sat down, and I looked at him, and I began. And I started in on my lecture on the nature of teasing. And I'll tell you, it was a thing of beauty. I mean, I had a great opening. I led in to my 3 points. I was walking through my 3 points about the nature of teasing. I couldn't hear angels singing, you know, but it was pretty close. I mean, I was, you know that point when you're talking and or you're doing anything and you reach that point where you have a hum? I was humming. And I was moving to my climax when I looked down at my son, my 7-year-old son, who is seated right across from me, and I see this look on his face. Right? So, once again, he was respectful. He was looking towards me, right? But he wasn't looking at me. He was probably looking through me. And, for a moment, I almost had, what's going on here? Why doesn't he understand? Again, I said, it was beautiful. Why isn't he understanding this? And in a moment of frustration, I said, Quinn, you're being an Edmund. Now, let me explain who Edmund is. A little bit of context here. Edmund is Edmund Pevensey. He is the third child in the Pevensey family. If you'll remember, it's Peter, Susan, Edmund, and then Lucy. Now, if you've read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, at least, you know the characteristics of Edmund. He is the pest, he's the liar, and he's the traitor. Right? All right, now back to my story. So after I blurted out to Quinn, you're being an Edmund, this is his response. I kid you not. He looked down at the floor and went like this. Like that. Honestly, I was amazed at the response. One name could carry that much weight with my son, Quinn. But it was interesting. It wasn't just the name that he connected with. It was the memories of the character. My son didn't want to be the liar, the pest, and the traitor. And what's really interesting is the memories that came in to his mind were not just of Edmund, but of the characters related to Edmund as well. So as soon as I said Edmund, it triggered in his mind this idea of the memories of Edmund, but it also triggered in his mind the memories of Peter. Now, I don't know how well you know Peter, but Peter is the protector of the family. You can see him here with Lucy. This is from Prince Caspian when they go down into the treasury and they discover all of their old tools. But these are the names of Peter in the Chronicles of Narnia. How about these names, right? Sir Peter Wolfsbane. I love that. Wolfsbane. If you were with me last night, we talked about the meaning that is connected to the word like characters like a fox, a lion, but also a wolf. Do you remember a wolf is ravenous? He's pursuing his own good, right? Wouldn't you like to be the bane of wolf? Wolfsbane, that's one of his names. High King Peter the Magnificent, Emperor of the Lone Islands, Lord of Caer Paravel. And this one's great because it's long, right? Knight of the Most Noble Order of the Lion. My son didn't want to be Edmund of the family. He wanted to be Peter. About the same time as this episode occurred, I was reading a collection of essays by Russell Kirk, who was referred to this morning in the introduction. And this is a wonderful, if you've never read Kirk, this is a wonderful introduction to Kirk, Redeeming the Time. And in this, there's an essay called The Perversity of Recent Fiction, and the subtitle of it is Reflections on the Moral Imagination. And I came upon this passage in the text. Now, if you were with me yesterday, you heard this, but it's worth hearing it again. And here's what it says. He poses a question and then answers the question. He says, what then is the end, object, or purpose of humane letters? And by humane letters, we mean literature, history, story, right? Why, and he answers it, why the expression of the moral imagination, or to put this truth in a more familiar phrase, the end of great books is ethical, to teach us what it means to be genuinely human. That's why they're called humane letters. To a Christian, we believe that it helps us realize who we were created to be, right? That's why we read story. That's why we read poetry. Now, this term, the moral imagination, was actually new to me. The concept that Kirk had talked about was not new to me, but this idea of the moral imagination, those two terms I'd not seen together before. So I began an investigation. What is this moral imagination that Kirk was talking about? Well, Kirk actually got it from Edmund Burke, a British statesman, who wrote a text called Reflections on the Revolution in France, 1790. And in it, he has this line. Now, those of you who are Lewis fans will love this, right? It's not just a closet, it's a wardrobe, right? A wardrobe of the moral imagination. So, moral imagination. Let's take these and let's do a little bit of a word study, shall we? What does it mean to be moral? What does that actually mean? Well, it means that you're living in accordance to principles or upright behavior. Upright, virtuous, right conduct, that's the idea. And these are classical ideas. In fact, we have the cardinal virtues, which I'm sure all of you promote in your school and you talk about frequently. And of course, they are prudence, which we might say wisdom, temperance, which is self-control. We have a lot of conversations about temperance in our house. In fact, I want my kids to know the word temperance, right? Fortitude, which is courage. And then last but not least of these cardinal virtues is justice, which in part is, in a practical way, honesty. It's more than that, but it's honesty, right? In addition, we have the three theological virtues. Again, you know this, right? We see it in 1 Corinthians 13. Faith, hope, and love. All right, so those are pretty good standards. Those are pretty good marks that we can aim towards in terms of trying to describe and to define moral in moral imagination. Now, what does it mean, though, to be moral? Well, I'm going to take a passage, one of my favorite passages from all of mere Christianity. I'm just going to read it to you because, again, Lewis captures this idea of what it means to be moral very clearly. And here it is. There's one further point about the virtues that ought to be noticed. Then he's going to talk about a difference. There is a difference between doing some particular just or temperate action and being a just or temperate man. Someone who is not a good tennis player may now and then make a good shot. What you mean by a good player is the man whose eyes and muscles and nerves have been so trained by making innumerable good shots that they can now be relied upon. They have a certain tone or quality which is there even when he is not playing, just as a mathematician's mind has a certain habit or outlook which is there even when he's not doing mathematics. In the same way, a man who perseveres in doing just action gets in the end a certain quality of character. Now, it is this quality of character rather than the particular actions which we mean when we talk about virtue. But as I learned with my own children, moral behavior is not the product of instruction alone, or lecture alone. If it had been, my eloquent exposition on teasing would have hit home with my son, but it didn't. I'm going to quote to you from a book that I've probably recommended more than any other book in the last 10 years. Many of you have read it, Tending the Heart of Virtue by Vigen Guroian. Guroian is a theology professor who has actually taught children's literature for many, many years on the East Coast at a variety of institutions. And here's what he said. I'll read it slowly. Near instruction, so my exposition on teaching, do this, don't do that. Mere instruction in morality is not sufficient. Now, I want you to pay attention to the word sufficient. He's not saying don't teach your kids explicitly rules, right? He's saying that that's not enough. You should tell your kids, don't steal, don't tell a lie. I tell my students this all the time. If your child is walking towards a hot stove, that's not the time to swoop in and say, hey, let me tell you a story, right? Don't touch the stove, right? But what Guroian is saying here is that mere instruction in morality is not sufficient to nurture its virtues. It may even backfire if that's all you give, mere instruction. Especially when the presentation is heavily exhortative or heavy-handed. The pupil's will is coerced. Instead, he says, a compelling vision of the goodness of goodness itself needs to be presented in a way that's attractive and stirs the imagination. You can see where I'm going with this. A good moral education addresses both the cognitive and the affective, the head and the heart as well. It affects the cognitive and the affective dimensions of human nature. If all you're giving is mere instruction, you're selling your children and your students short. So the imagination somehow plays into this idea of cultivating a heart of virtue. So what do we mean by the word imagination, right? Well, before I give you a little bit of a definition of that, I wanted to read you a newspaper article that I came across a couple of years ago. And here it is. It was in the New York Daily News. It was from January the 31st, 2015. Here's the headline of the article. Texas boy suspended after bringing, and it's in quotes, ring of power to school. So here it is. Kermit Elementary officials called it a threat when 9-year-old boy, and they named the kid in here, Aiden Stewart. So, the 9-year-old boy, Aiden Stewart, in a playful act of make-believe, told a classmate that he could make him disappear with a ring forged in the fictional Middle Earth Mount Doom. I love this kid. All right, it keeps going. And then they quote the boy's father. Quote, it sounded unbelievable. Right? He insists that his son, quote, didn't mean anything by it, which is good. Now, here's a little bit of context. The Stuarts had just watched The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, a few days earlier, inspiring Aiden's imagination and leading him to proclaim that he had in his possession, okay, the author of this has to have a sense of humor. So again, leading him to proclaim that he had in his possession the one ring to rule them all. Aiden claimed Thursday that he could put a ring on his friend's head and make him invisible like Bilbo Baggins, who stole Gollum's, and this is in quotes, who stole Gollum's precious and J.R. Tolkien's fantasy, The Lord of the Rings. And then they quote the father again, which is just great. It's a little bit heartbreaking too. Listen to this. I assure you my son lacks the magical powers necessary to I understand what he's trying to do, but isn't that sad a little bit? If I'd have been interviewed, I would have said, you better believe he does. So let me read it again. I assure you my son lacks the magical powers necessary to threaten his friend's existence. But then he comes back. He says, if he did, I'm sure he would bring him right back. Isn't that great? Three cheers for Aiden. Oh, that's so good. All right, so I'm not a cognitive psychologist, so I'm not going to give you a psychological definition of the imagination. Believe it or not, I stumbled across this a few years ago in Jean Vieth's book on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I've yet to see it matched. It's just good because he actually gives you the opportunity to test it out in his description. So it's a longer quote, hang with me, but you'll actually be able to do something here in a moment. So here we go. This is Vieth's words. The word imagination does not simply mean making things up, nor does it have anything to do with being creative, as when artsy types make excuses for themselves, which is pretty funny, and try to impress us by insisting how imaginative they are. Rather, the word imagination refers to the power that we all have, one that we all nearly take for granted, despite how astonishing it really is. Our imagination is simply our amazing ability to conjure up images in our mind. That's right on, right? A wardrobe of images. Conjure up images in our mind. We do not think just in ideas or abstractions. We also think with our imagination. That is, we think in images, in tangible details that partake of our senses. Even though we are only contemplating them in our mind, our language, let alone our literature, depends on metaphors. We use metaphors even when we think in abstractions, as when we speak of grasping an idea. And then he has it in parentheses, a metaphor of a hand grabbing onto something, or comprehending a concept, which simply is actually based on the Latin word, which means to grasp with the hand. Our powers of imagination include the astounding ability to call up experiences from the past. This is called memory. Think of a tree that you used to climb and play around. We can do it immediately. We can imagine what we are going to do in the future. And then he says this, think about how the leaves of that tree will change color in the autumn. And how you will then rake them. We can even imagine, now this is the part that goes beyond, and this is the part that's really important. We can even imagine things that do not exist except as something we've created in our minds. And then he gives us an experiment. So we're going to do it together. Ready? Think of a tree. Go ahead. Now make it blue. Now plaid. I don't know about you, but I have never seen a plaid tree, except in my mind, right? How am I able to do that? Well, my girls go to a school where they wear plaid skirts. So I've seen plaid before. In fact, I have a picture of my dad when he was in his 20s, and he's wearing a plaid shirt, right? Now, the plaid tree that I have, I don't know what yours looks like, but mine is blue and brown with a little kind of a lighter stripe through it. Where does that come from? My girl's plaid skirts, my dad's plaid shirt, all of those images coming together into a created image in my mind. Right? That's the imagination. So now, how does moral and imagination, how are these two connected? There's another book that I would recommend to you, William Kilpatrick's book, Books That Build Character. He wrote it with Gregory and Suzanne Wolfe. Gregory Wolfe worked in Seattle. He was the writer in residence. He and his wife are pretty well-known writers and poets. And they work together on this book. It's a wonderful book. The book itself is only about 60 pages long, and then there's about 200 pages of recommended books that they would recommend at every single level. And they break it up into picture books, chapter books, history, all of that. It's a wonderful book. But the essay at the beginning, about 60 pages long, is phenomenal in dealing with this idea of cultivating the moral imagination. And this is what Kilpatrick says in the opening of this book. He says, imagination is one of the keys to virtue. It is not enough to know what's right. It is also necessary to desire to do right. So it's not just enough to know. Me telling my son that teasing is wrong, right, is not enough. He has to have a desire to do what's right. Desire, in turn, is directed to a large extent by the imagination. In theory, reason should guide our moral choices, right? We should be able to think logically and come up with, oh, I should act in this way. But in practice, it is the imagination, much more than reason, that calls the shots. And then he says this, and you'll hear echoes of Plato in this. Too often our reason obediently submits to what our imagination has already decided. Right? It would be great if we could rationally work these things out and say, then I will act in this particular way. But that's not how our minds think. Our minds think with the imagination. Now, part of the idea of education is to cultivate the capacities for rational thought, right? We want our students to think clearly, to think logically, to think rationally, to lay these things out. And that's an important part, especially as they grow older. But children are led by desire, and I would say adults are led by desire as well. So you can connect to this as well, I'm sure. My former colleague at Hillsdale, John Fennell, wrote a wonderful essay answering this question, what is the moral imagination? And it's available on the Imaginative Conservative, which is a website. And here's what he said. You'll hear echoes of this, of what I've already said. He says this, the moral imagination is a store of images or a wardrobe of images. Images pertaining to ideas, principles, meanings, and possibilities in terms of which one grasps the world. Do you hear these terms coming up over and over again? And thereby in light of which one acts. But the way one acts is a synonym for character. Thus, the building of the moral imagination is the formation of character. And to the degree that parents and teachers systematically involve themselves in the activity, they are engaged in character education. I'd go back to my verse, Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go. That's what we're talking about here. Cultivating the moral imagination is character development. So if you're relying on your inspirational posters, be courageous, right? Here's what courage is. Let's recite back courage. All of that is good, right? But it's not enough. It's going to require more. Character education, the cultivation of virtue, depends upon a healthy moral imagination. The reason why the name Edmund made more of an impact on my son than my well-crafted argument on the nature of teasing was that his imagination, his wardrobe was, I'm very thankful to say, was well-stocked with a healthy collection of images from which to draw. So then how do we do this? If the moral imagination is so important for character development, how do we do this? Well, you'll not be surprised, because of the title of this, that stories play a role in this. Some of you have read this book before, Beauty and the Word, Rethinking the Foundation of Education by Stratford Caldecott. And I'm going to read a quote from this to you, and I'm going to show you some of the texts that he mentions in this quote here. He says this, the Velveteen Rabbit, the Little Mermaid, the Wind in the Willows, the Snow Queen, Beauty and the Beast, and the Chronicles of Narnia reveal an aspect of what it is to be truly human, not in a moralistic way, but by spelling out rules and regulations of right behavior, but in a way that educates the imagination of the reader to see patterns of linking characters, decisions, and events in the real world. It is a way not just of communicating rules, but also of showing how the rules work, and perhaps more importantly, why they work, right? A more dynamic explanation of the rules, because they're actually lived out. However fantastic or unreal the landscapes in which these stories unfold, however untrue to life they may be in the factual sense, they are truer, or they are true in the deeper meaning of the word, in that they reflect the way things really are. They open our eyes to look not merely at the surface of things, but at their form. Later on today, I'm going to be talking about fairy tales, why fairy tales are so important. And he touches on one of the reasons why. That by changing the natural world, right, by making things, by allowing people to fly, by allowing us to see dragons, by changing the natural world, but preserving the moral principles in them, it actually draws our attention to those moral principles. That's what he's touching on there. Regardless of how wild the world is in that story, the morals retain are still true. You'll never have a hero be uncourageous and rewarded for it, right? Courage is always honored. Justice is always honored, as wild as the rest of the story may be. All right, I'm going to skip over a slide here, and hopefully we'll come back to it. Let me give you an example from The Goose Girl. How many of you have read The Goose Girl before? All right. Now, this is actually a pretty old Grimm's tale, and it's oftentimes collected in the Grimm's fairy tales, but it's not one of the more popular ones, Cinderella, Snow White, you know, those kind. It's typically down a level, but it's usually included. And I would highly recommend it. Some of you perhaps have read Shannon Hale's recent revision of that story. It's a longer kind of novel. I'm going to go from the Grimm's tale itself. I'm going to tell you a little bit about, I'm going to tell you the story. I was going to read it to you, but it's just a little too long. So I'll kind of tell you the story, and then I'll pinpoint a few things that really draw these out. I'll pinpoint a few of the images that are pretty strong in here. So here we go. The Goose Girl, by the Brothers Grimm. So an old queen gives her daughter in marriage to a prince that the princess has never met before in a faraway kingdom. The princess and her handmaid make the long journey together. All right. So those of you who know this story will already recognize it. All right. During the journey, a couple of things happen. One of the important things oftentimes in a fairy tale is the main character of the story has to remember or do a particular thing. And trouble results when that main character does not remember or do the thing that she or he was supposed to do. And in this case, the queen mother gave the princess a couple of treasures. It depends on the version. It could be a handkerchief with three drops of blood, or it could be a lock of her hair. Regardless of what it is, it's a very personal item. And she says to the princess, remember this, don't lose this, all right? It's almost kind of the mother's protection over the daughter as she travels. Well, she does not take care, right? And she loses the object. And in the story, the handmaid notices that she loses this object of protection. And the handmaiden recognizes that the princess is now no longer under the protection of the mother. And she realizes she can take action. And that's exactly what she does. She comes down and she forces the princess to trade positions with her. They trade clothing. And she said, now I will be the princess and you will be the handmaid. And so they change roles. And then she threatens her with her life. She says, if you tell anyone, I'll kill you, right? So she's living in fear. Now, they travel the rest of the way to the kingdom, and the prince is there, and the king of that kingdom is there as well. Now, when they arrive through the gates, depending on the story, it'll be presented in a wide variety of ways. But one thing is clear. He spots who he thinks is the princess, and he rushes down, rushes out, swoops her up, and carries her off, right? And then we get this line, but the old king. Now, just for a moment, let me pause. Those of you who are Narnia fans, I personally believe that there are central moments in the chronicle where the future and the hope of Narnia hangs on an instant, a moment. And there's an instant in the silver chair when they're in the room with the lady with the green kirtle, right? And she begins to play music, and they all go into this haze, and they're all drooping their heads, and she almost, it's an amazing chapter. They're almost all going to sleep, and then you get this line, but puddle glum, right? And all of Narnia changes on those two words. He walks over in his stupor and puts his foot in the fire, right? And it wakes them up, and from then on, they're saved, right? You get the same kind of a thing here. So the prince comes down, swoops up the princess, who he thinks is the princess, carries her off, but the old king. Now, one thing about the word old, in a lot of Grimm's tale, when you see old, you don't need to say wise, because old means wise. In our modern fairy tales, if you want to say a character is wise, you now have to do it. But if you wanted to say it was a wise character, you say it old. Because, again, more often than not, old meant wise. So the old king observes what's going on and says, something is not right here, right? And then he spends a large portion of the middle of the story pursuing this thing that just doesn't seem right to him. And it's really interesting. It's hard to remember that this guy is a king, because he comes down from his throne and goes off on his own to pursue this throughout his own castle. He even goes out, if you know the story, the handmaid, or the real princess who's the handmaid, gets turned into a goose girl, and she is asked to take care of the geese. And the king actually comes down off of his throne and goes and hides and watches her because he knows that something is not right. And he pursues it. Eventually, he ends up confronting the goose girl, she's now called, and that's what the title of the story is, and asks her, there's something not right here. You need to tell me. She says, no, I can't tell you. I can't tell you. I made a promise. And she's scared for her life. And so the king says, that's fine. And depending on the version you read, he ends up overhearing the story. In the most prominent version, the goose girl is actually talking to the stove. And she tells her story. And the king, remember he's a king, is hiding behind the stove and hears the story. Upon hearing the story, he calls for the royal robes to be brought in and for the goose girl to be robed in her royal clothing. And then he asks her to stand before him, right? These are great images, very powerful images, perhaps you've seen elsewhere. Then he calls for his son, the prince, to come in and look upon her as well. Now, that's important. We'll come back to that in a moment. And then he calls for a banquet to be had. And he invites the entire court to the banquet. And he puts the prince in a chair. And he puts the false princess, she's actually called that, the false princess on one side. And then the real princess, who is now in her royal clothes, on the other side. Now, it says that the handmaiden or the false princess does not recognize that it is the true princess, right? And so part of the way through the evening, he says, I have a story to tell. And then he turns to the false princess and he tells the story of the goose girl, what had happened to her. And of course, the false princess does not realize that the true princess is seated right there. And he says this, what should happen to this person who would do such a treacherous thing? And the false princess says this, you need to get a cask or a barrel and hammer nails into it and then have that be dragged around through the streets until the person is dead. At that moment, the king stands up and says, you are the person. Does that sound like something, right? The prophet Nathan asking David, right? You see these images occurring in these after. He says, you are the one, and thus you have declared your judgment. And she's thrown into the barrel, and she's dragged throughout the streets and destroyed. Then the princess, the true princess, and the prince are united together, and it absolutely happily ever after, and the story ends. All right, so that's the story. It's a great story in itself. It's full of images of goodness, right? They're all over the place. But I want to draw your attention to two aspects of the story that one of them is a little more obvious and one of them is actually hidden, and it occurs, this image occurs over time. So here we go. The story is primarily about justice. Now, there's a lot of children's stories that are about courage. There are lots of stories about kindness, but this is a story about justice. Something in the kingdom was out of place, and although it was difficult to see, there was disorder in the kingdom. Justice has to do with the restoration of order. The old king was only willing to celebrate when order to his kingdom was restored, and the true princess was in her rightful place. Justice, of course, is one of the cardinal virtues. Prudence, temperance, fortitude, justice. But there's a little treasure in this story that's easily overlooked, and I want to point it out to you. Oh, by the way, I'm going to give you homework. I would encourage you to read this story. You can go this evening, just like, type it in Google, and you can read it. It's very short, just a couple of pages long. And look for this. Prior to the scene that I told you about, every time in the story that they refer to the bridegroom, he is referred to as the young prince. But after he is shown by his wise old father what justice looks like, the young man was able to see it for himself. And it was then and only then that he was called, are you ready for this? The young king. Doesn't that give you chills? And every version in English that I have seen has this in it. So throughout every point in the story, he's referred to as the young prince, the young prince, the young prince. But it was only when he looked upon the bride in her rightful place is he referred to as the young king. One of the central responsibilities of a king is to act justly. A prince does not deserve to be king if he cannot recognize injustice and act justly. This is true for a king. This is true for a mature adult as well. One more thing from the Goose Girl before I go on. Do you remember the point when the king asks the Goose Girl to be robed in her royal clothing, and then she's brought back in and put before him? And this is what it says. Quote, the king ordered royal clothes to be put on her, and he gazed on her in wonder. Classical education begins in wonder. Here's a king who knew what justice was and pursued justice. And when he saw justice taking place, when he saw it, the princess in her rightful place, he himself wondered. He had no, wonder means having no explanation for it. In some translations, they say he was in awe. Or he was in amazement. The word amazement actually has an original meaning of paralysis. So here's a king who knows justice, puts justice in place, and when he observes it, looks upon it, he himself is in wonder. All right, let me end with this. Oh, by the way, that was this slide right here. A good place to end is with the two towers. I mean, we can see this actually being played out in The Lord of the Rings, specifically in the two towers. And some of you already know the passage that I'm going to read because it hits this so well. And this, of course, is the hero of the story speaking, who is Samwise Gamgee. He says this, I know, it's all wrong. By rights, we shouldn't even be here, but we are. It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo, the ones that really matter, full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't know how, and sometimes you didn't want to know the end, because how could the end be happy? It's interesting that Tolkien wrote an essay on fairy stories where he talks about eucatastrophe. That's what Sam is talking about right here. How could it end happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. When the sun shines, it will shine out clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you. Talk about the imagination, right? Those are the images that stay with you. That meant something, even if you were too small to understand why. Your students, right? Even if you don't understand it fully, those are the images that stay with you. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folks in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't. They kept going because they were holding on to something. To cultivate the moral imagination in your students, your children, your grandchildren, your nieces and nephews. In other words, to train them up in the way that they should go, give them something worth holding on to. Give them a wardrobe of images, and even when they are old, they will not depart from it. There are my references, Anna. Thank you very much. We have a couple of minutes, so I'm willing to take a few questions if you'd like. I promise I'll release you early. In fact, if I hear them releasing, I'll just say, go, 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 so you can get to the book event or whatever you want to do. But are there any questions that you might have? Well, the question was this: what happens if we get students in the upper school, right? So a lot of schools oftentimes will quit taking students after the 10th grade, right? But that still means that you're taking students in the 9th grade, in the 10th grade, in the 8th grade who haven't had this formation. Immediately, the words of my dad come to mind: it's never too late to do the right thing, right? And so, right, you can't count on the fact that they've had this moral formation, they've had this storehouse of images, but it's time to do it now, right? So do what you can. So I talk about children's literature a lot, but this is true of human story, right? It doesn't have to be children's stories. It's just that oftentimes of the fairy tales, it's more black and white. We're easily able to see it. But all stories cultivate our humanity. That's what Kirk was talking about there. Oh, and by the way, unless you think, yes, my students need to develop their moral imagination. You do too. In fact, right now, your imagination is being cultivated. Right? My imagination is being cultivated. My elevator ride down this morning cultivated my imagination. So did the death grip. I'm just kidding. So it's never too late, right, to do the right thing. It's never too late to teach them stories. We don't stop teaching them stories after the elementary grades. We continue to offer them stories. Now, what I will say is it's not easy, right? It's not easy at the lower levels. It's not easy at the upper levels as well. And the later they go, it's just like learning to read. If you have a 14-year-old kid who's never been taught how to read, that kid can read, but it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of patience and a lot of time. And oftentimes, the things that really matter take time to cultivate, including the moral imagination. Another issue that I'm concerned about is we're growing up in a culture, and I'm not going to rage against the culture here, but your kids are growing up, your students are growing up, you grew up, even many of you, in a culture that's saturated with prepackaged images, right? The images are already there. As much as I possibly can in our household, we tell our kids, our three kids, you have to read the book before you watch the movie, right? That's just a rule. Right, and if you want to see the movie, you got to read the book, because I want the book to have a first crack at forming the images in their mind. Now, I'm not fooled into thinking that the movie or the television show won't change those images. They will, right? The images are being collected, but I want that book to have a first crack at it, right? To form those images in their mind, because oftentimes those first images are the ones that are the strongest. That ought to be humbling for us. Be careful what you put before your students' eyes, right? We were talking about this last night. Poetry is powerful, right? Poems that kids hear in the younger years have a way of staying there for the rest of their life. I teach children's literature at Hillsdale, and I ask my students to memorize Jabberwocky. And I tell them, you're gonna memorize it, and then I say, you're welcome. I say, because that's my gift to you, because that is going to be bouncing around in your mind for the rest of your life. And then I require them to come to my office. It's an excuse to get to know them, actually. I require them to come to my office, and they have to recite it at my desk. It's so interesting. They come in, and, you know, a few of them are just really cocky. Twas brilliant in the slide. They're looking at their watch. Others are just so nervous. And I usually tell them, I won't even look at you. And so I usually stare out the window. I've had students actually say, can I stand? And so they stand. I had one kid put music to it, and he sang it to me. So pretty great. All right, that was way off topic. So let's see. All right, we have time for one more question or comment. Yes, please. Oh, wow. How much time do we have, right? No, I think you're right. I've seen Peterson speak. I've not read his book, or the most prominent one, The 12. But what he's doing is he's recognizing truth, right? He's recognizing the truths that we were talking about here today. He's just looking at human nature and recognizing that we are created in the image of God, right? God has created us to be story-loving beings, right? So in his case, he's just made that recognition. Now, I can't get into his mind. I don't know what his personal relationship with the Lord is. But he hasn't been able to make that step between the image that he sees in human nature, that we are a reflection of a holy God. What we can do for him is we can pray for him, right? But that means, again, that the images that we set before our children are critically important. They must reflect truth, goodness, and beauty. Again, going back to Vegan Groyan, not in a heavy-handed way. In fact, if you didn't get this already, this is an indirect approach. It's not in your face. It takes more time, but it's deeper as well. And I would say that those truths rest on the Word of God, on our understanding of God. And I'm very grateful for that, because I think we have a firm foundation where people who do not have that kind of a relationship, they do not have that foundation. And we should pray for them. We absolutely should. So. All right, thanks again for your time. I'm going to be up here. If you have more questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But I really enjoyed our time together, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your time. Thanks.